You're listening to a podcast of spurious morality.
Hello and welcome to a podcast of spurious morality. I'm Johnston, and with me this week I have Greg.
Good day, everybody.
And I have Jimmy.
How many Nymon have you seen today?
How many Spodcasters have you listened to today? Yes, we're doing season 17. Season by season has reached season 17, which feels like a long way in now. Like, we've been doing this for a good few years, and we're sort of getting towards the end of Tom Baker, which is mad. But it's an interesting one, season 17. It's a bit of a Marmite season. A lot of people love it. A lot of people hate it or certainly aren't so keen on it. It's very unique. It's got its own tone. It's got its own script editor, Douglas Adams, and wow, he brings his influence to it. So I think that we've got some interesting stuff to explore here. So first up, what are our favourites from season 17? Let's go there first. So, Greg, what's your favourite serial from this season?
I mean, it's not going to be any surprise that I say City of Death. I think most people would say that, so I will instead say that my second favourite story from season 17 is Shada, and whether that's because of how they put it together in the most recent assembly and animation, could be, but I also think it's got the second best script out of the season as well, so we will talk about it later, but those are my two favorites.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of difficult to pick a favorite without saying City of Death this season, because it is run away the best story. Is quite difficult to do, but yeah, I agree about Shada as well. It's a very, very good story. What about you, Jimmy?
I mean, I like City of Death, but I do also think it's one of the more overrated stories of the classic series, which, yeah, I'm expecting to get a lot of people not happy to hear that, but I do like it. But overall, I would have to say the whole season 17, the tone is so weird and ridiculous that you've got to go for the weird and ridiculous, the one that exemplifies that. And for me, it's just Horns of Nymon is so ridiculous and so fun and so stupid. I can't help but love it.
How many people that say the Horns of Nymon is their favourite from season 17 have you seen today? Probably just the one, to be fair. But yeah, fair enough. That's an interesting choice. I can't argue with it. I think Horns of Nymon gets a lot of stick that it doesn't deserve. I'm going to kind of do what Greg did. And like I say, I can't bring myself to say that City of Death is not the best story for this season. However, there is a story here that does stand out that I do really enjoy watching, perhaps even more than City. And that's Nightmare of Eden, which is a really strange story. Like, you know, we talk about how there's an odd tone to this season. Tones are even all over the place. This story is just the epitome of that. It's a dark and gritty drama about drug addiction, done in the house style of Douglas Adams. It's utterly bonkers. And we've got monsters that are so bad it's comedic in itself. It's mad. It's an absolutely mad story. But we'll discuss that more when we get to it. And I have a funny feeling Greg's going to tell me off for liking it and tell me it's really rubbish and probably be right, but never mind. Let's crack on. Let's crack on with Destiny of the Daleks, Terry Nation's final Doctor Who script. You know, considering we were talking about Terry Nation in the very first season by season we ever did, that's quite massive. His presence hasn't really been felt for a while, and he's, you know, had big gaps away from the series before, but this one is a bit of an oddity because it's a sequel to Genesis of the Daleks at a time where Doctor Who stories didn't really have sequels to each other. But this brings back Davros, not particularly amazingly, I think it's fair to say. You know, the Davros we get here is nothing like the brilliance of the Davros that we get in Genesis of the Daleks, but I'm glad the character comes back. The Daleks are looking a bit tired and knackered. These are very, very old props at this stage. And the whole thing just looks a bit shoddy, for want of a better word. I think the Mavellans look great. I think the Mavellan spaceship looks fantastic. The effect of it burying itself is brilliant. There's a lot that does look really good in this story. But for everything that looks really good, there's a costume that we've seen 70 million times before reused. There's Daleks that just look like they're a bit old and knackered. And I know part of the plot is the Daleks are a bit old and knackered, but it's the actual props that look shoddy and not. They don't look war-torn. They look shoddy, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. I do really like, and I think it's unique to this story, and perhaps an odd thing to pick out, but the effect of the Daleks' weapons. I think the blue ray that comes out is different to any other story, and there's quite a nice sound effect as well. It's almost a bit, I don't know, glass-breaky or watery. So it's a very, very different sort of sounding and looking Dalek weapon in this one, and it sort of quite works. They do look, that at least does look more advanced than the Daleks in Genesis, and for once gives the impression that the Daleks in Genesis were very, very early models. Overall, fun enough story, but it's never, ever, ever going to be listed on my favourites. I think it starts weak. I'm not a big fan of the way Romana regenerates, and I just don't think it particularly goes anywhere. And also, it completely robs us of the opportunity to see K-9 meeting the Daleks. It's such a shame K-9 doesn't really get a role in this one. But overall, it's not the worst Doctor Who's ever been, and it's not the worst it's ever going to be either, but it's also far from the best. But that's enough for me. What about you, Greg? What do you think of Destiny of the Daleks?
Well, we'll get this one out of the way right away. This is my least favorite story of season 17, which is for many of the same reasons that you just listed. It's, like you said, Terry Nation's last script for the series, and while obviously there wouldn't be Doctor Who as we know it without Terry Nation, and while he did contribute some good and influential stories to the Doctor Who canon, at this point, it's more than a good thing that he is no longer going to be writing for the series, because even now he is still writing as though it is the early 1960s, and we're watching stage plays on television. The pace here is glacial. Almost nothing happens from moment to moment. You can sum up pretty much every one of the four episodes in a couple of sentences. It looks cheap, which is unusual for a season opener, but of course we know that the budget was really being stretched to the limit around this time. Like you said, the Daleks don't look good at all. I admire David Gooderson for, you know, giving Davros his best shot, but I think he's unfortunately the worst Davros performer we've had and will have. Nothing about it really functions. I mean, you can tell Douglas Adams has no time, like, for this script, just from the, you know, from, oh, look, rocks, like, right at the beginning. He's just satirizing the whole thing from within. I agree that the regeneration scene for Romana just turns it into a weird gag. And I mean, that's fine, I guess, but it just doesn't really fit well with the tone of the story, which is at least intended to be very downbeat, but of course is, you know, shifted by the Douglas Adams humor. You can also tell right away that, you know, this is the season in which, like, Tom Baker is very out of control. Like, he dominates every scene that he's in. His scenes with Davros are ridiculous looking. I really don't have much good to say about this one at all. It's and there's like dramatic playing of rock, paper, scissors. You know, that's exciting too. I don't have a lot of good to say about this one. It's tedious. It's boring. It's the worst, I think, classic Dalek story. This or death to the, yeah, I would say this is the worst one. So yeah, not off to a great start here in season 17, but fortunately that will change significantly with the next one.
Yeah, I'd struggle to disagree with anything you've just said there, really. It's like I say, this isn't the worst Doctor Who gets. It feels like a bit of a pile on, but it doesn't have much going for it. What really annoys me is that at the same time as this, Terry Nation was writing Blake 7, which wasn't like early 60s drama. It was quite ahead of its time, a little bit forward-looking, and still had a lot of the sort of sinister, dark, fascist-like undertones that, you know, a lot of his Doctor Who work has. But it's not stage on screen, as you say this is. So he's capable of doing better than this. He is just phoning this one in. Like you say, Douglas Adams has definitely script edited this to fit his style, but I'm not sure the styles of Terry Nation and Douglas Adams are in any way, shape or form compatible. And that's exactly what this is. It's a bit of a confused, stylistic, non-stylistic mess. Jimmy, what about you?
Yeah, I'd have to say it's, as you say, the tone's jarring. The two writers' different styles don't blend well. It's, yeah, the new Davros is rubbish, just like in the rest of this season. The new K-9 is rubbish. We're just lucky the new Romana wasn't rubbish because Lala Ward is excellent. But, yeah, this story is just so poor. Like, and it's not just the writing. There's also, I mean, first, the Romana changing bodies scene is just so silly. I think we're lucky the new series sort of accidentally given us a explanation with that whole 15 hours after regeneration, blah, blah, when the Doctor regrew his hands. So you can say, well, she wasn't just going off and killing herself and coming out in a new body. But, yeah, it's such a ridiculous scene. And then there's all the padding with looking, what could the Daleks be looking for before you get to Davros? And, yeah, Davros gets handled so badly, like not just the performance, but there's that whole chase scene where they're pushing him along, and then the bit where the Doctor throws a bomb down Davros's Dalek base, runs away, and the editing is terrible because if he'd just run away and then pressed the button and it was too late, Davros had got it out fine, but he runs away and then he just sort of stops, stands in the middle of nowhere. We cut to Davros, the bomb gets taken out, and then he's like, oh, I better actually blow this up. It's just the editing and the directing there was terrible. And then there's this weird part where the Doctor's surprised when he finds the Khaled mutant goop thing, and he's like, oh, yeah, the Daleks were originally organic, but at the same time he'd mentioned the Khaleds earlier, and so it's like, one scene he's forgetting they used to be organic, but in another scene he's talking about when they used to be. It's just, yeah, so badly handled and badly executed in pretty much every regards. I think the only nice thing I liked was a bit about the end when they were talking about, oh, the robots versus robots, they're never going to win and all that, and Romana being like, do you think you win because you make mistakes? And I thought, yeah, okay, that was one clever, good line in the whole story. So, yeah, definitely quite a letdown and not a good start to the season.
Yeah, I find the whole Daleks as robots thing in this to be quite weird because, like, the new series really gets Daleks right on that level. It's like, no, the Daleks aren't robots. They're not free from emotion. It's just that anger and hatred are pretty much the only ones they've got going. And that works so much better than the idea that they're just robots, and if they come up against literally any other robots, they are screwed. Like that, right. The Daleks.
You could argue that, you know, okay, sure, if this was like a new writer coming in to Doctor Who or something like that, you know, okay, they don't really understand that. I mean, this is the guy who created them. Like, how does this happen? Like, how do you forget? I don't know.
Like, not even that. Like, Terry Nation lived in a very, very big house when he wrote this because of those things. It's bizarre. But that's Destiny of the Daleks done. I'm more than happy to move on at this point, so let's do so. Let's go to City of Death, which... It's good. I like City of Death. I genuinely do think it deserves the reputation it has. It is just Douglas Adams all over. You know, David Agnew wrote this one. We know full well it's a David Fisher story that Douglas Adams had an awful lot to do with, and that's probably the two best writers of Doctor Who of this sort of late 70s era. And as a result, we do get something that's maybe not too big, too clever. We've seen villains like Scaroth before. We've not necessarily had stories, you know, based around the art world and that kind of thing before. You know, I like Paris as a setting as well. It has a few things that does make it stand out as a very unique story. But in terms of plot, it is basically just alien wants to, you know, invade Earth, prevent creation of humanity, all the usual things, something, you know, the Master has tried 17 times already. But it's just the humour. I love the humour in this. This is Douglas Adams let loose. This is Douglas Adams properly being able to be Douglas Adams while writing Doctor Who. And every single scene has something to at least make you smile. And it really does feel as though effort has been put into this story. You know, we've talked over seasons 15 and 16 how, you know, maybe some things are getting a bit slapdash. It's not looking as good as it could. It's not, no one's taking it too seriously, where all of a sudden this story, everything feels like it's coming into place. The script has had the extra draft that it probably needed. Tom and Lala are clearly enjoying themselves. You know, we've got two leads that are bringing their A game to this story. Duggan is such a fantastic addition, a great sort of one-off companion type character. Paris as a setting really does work. You've even got sort of a little cameo from John Cleese in this. You know, it really feels like they've put the effort in to make this story work. And it shows that, you know, at a time where Doctor Who is criticised for being a bit shoddy, it can still pull out all the stops when it wants to. Helps that it's a fairly effects-light story. I know that we've got sort of model shots of the spaceship, which look fantastic. Prehistoric Earth being recreated in a studio, it could be better, but I'm not going to knock a mark off the story because of that. I really just think we're on to a great Doctor Who story here. And I think it's because everybody just knew they were onto something good and really wanted to make it work when it was being produced. Greg, go ahead. Talk to us about City of Death.
Yeah, I mean, it for me, it's hard to find much to criticize here. I agree with you that the plot is probably the weakest element of the story. And I do think that despite the fact that it's wonderful, beautiful padding, I do think the story definitely gets padded out in the third episode. There's a whole lot of like escaping the mansion and then like being brought back to it. But that aside, there's nothing I can point to here and say this doesn't work. I mean, it's one of the best directed classic series stories we've had. Like the location shooting in Paris is amazing. They're going for little, you know, flourishes, like the shot through the kiosk with the greeting cards. That, I mean, that's amazing filmmaking for this kind of show and for Doctor Who historically. Postcards, that's the word I was looking for. And I think the music, too, is one of the best scores Doctor Who ever had, if not the best. The music is just wonderful, and even though it doesn't have lyrics, I would say it is lyrical. It manages to tell a story in itself. And yeah, that's great. The production's great. The acting, I mean, as I said with Destiny of the Daleks, you know, this is the season where Tom Baker was pretty much doing whatever he wanted. But even at that point, you know, Tom always had respect for, you know, great writing and great scripting. And you can tell here he's having the time of his life firing off these Douglas Adams lines. Lala Ward is a fantastic foil for him as well. Like, she does great. Duggan's a great character. Oh, and then don't forget, we've got Julian Glover back playing Count Scarleone, you know, seeing him for the first time since the Crusade back in the 60s. And, you know, here he's only a couple years removed from being a James Bond villain. So, I mean, this is one of the highest profile villain actors Doctor Who ever had at any point in its history. And he's completely fantastic with the genteel menace, you know, sort of thing. And don't forget the plot either. I mean, we say this every so often, but despite the fact that Doctor Who is a series about time travel, very few Doctor Who stories, especially in the classic series, use Doctor Who's time travel capability within the story. Usually it's just they land somewhere, they're there, this is where they're staying. This is one of the few stories where they actually, where the Doctor travels back and forth in time, in the story, to gather information, and the revelation that Scarleone is back in the Renaissance period is it's a fantastic cliffhanger. Like, because Doctor Who doesn't do this very often, you don't even really consider that Scarleone can be in two places at once. But it's not, and granted, that's not because he himself is time traveling. It's because he's been splintered. But it's still shocking because the series never went to this well very often, and it took one of its greatest writers to really embrace that and play with it here. I mean I could spend this whole episode raving about City of Death, but I mean it's one of my favorite classic stories, one of my favorite Doctor Who stories, period, of all time, and I don't think anything's ever going to knock it from that status.
I think this is perhaps the perfect story to show, or perfect classic story to show someone who's not seen classic Doctor Who before as well. Like, this is classic Doctor Who firing on all cylinders, looking great, and it's a Tom Baker story. Like, I definitely think you could do a lot worse than show this to someone who's not really familiar with it. Tell them it's not like this every week, by all means, but go, this is just a really, really good example of why Doctor Who is so enduring. It does stand out. I think it particularly stands out because of when it was made, because we don't have as many fantastic stories in the Graham Williams era. It's a shame to say, but, you know, it's something we have come to discover over the course of doing these season by seasons. You know, when you think that season 14 is pretty much belting out a classic every week, and here we are season 17, and we're like, yeah, this is really, really good. There's definitely a bit of a gulf there. But also, Julian Glover, should have mentioned Julian Glover before. What a fantastic performance. Absolutely fantastic villain. And not only James Bond a few years later, but also a fairly small role in Empire Strikes Back. And of course, went on to be an Indiana Jones villain as well. As far as villainous bingo goes, I'm pretty sure Julian Glover's got a fuller card than pretty much anybody else. Jimmy, go on then. You're not as big a fan, are you? Talk to us about why.
I think it's so overrated doesn't help, because, like, everyone seems to love it, but there is a lot of good stuff in it, but there's also a lot of stuff that's just frustrating or annoying. Like, I think it's trying a bit too hard on the humour at some points, like the, oh, will we take the lift or fly joke, or the John Cleese sequence that's utterly pointless, to be honest, and sometimes they're trying to make it sound all clever or pretentious or whatever, and they're like, just overdo it. Like that whole thing with, especially in the early first episode, the repetition. Oh, it's marvellous. Wouldn't you say it's marvellous? Oh, yes, marvellous. Marvellous. Marvellous is the word for it. Marvellous. Bouquet, bouquet, bouquet. It just, thank goodness they stopped doing that after the first episode, because it really irritated me so much. And the other thing is that is very popular with the story is Duggan, and I just found him so irritating and annoying. Like, he has that one good moment where he's the clever enough to figure out why there's seven Mona Lisas before the others, but the rest of the time he's like setting off the alarm in the Louvre, smashing a wine glass to pour it. It's just so silly and over the top, and the performance is just not that good. And same some other things, like the cafe patrons when, you know, Duggan and Romana and the Doctor are getting held up and they're talking about stealing Mona Lisa and everyone's just like, yeah, no reaction. Like, I mean, it's something that happens a lot with background actors in a lot of stories, but it's just really noticeable here. And the first episode cliffhanger, like Scarif goes and looks into a mirror and he starts taking off his mask and he puts it back on again. Like, what? Why is he doing that? What's the point? It's just so silly. But I will go on to, like, some of the good stuff. Like, I've got to say, Romana is brilliant in this, and I think the best little bit is when she figures out the little puzzle box and Scaroff's wife is all like, oh, you're not going to do it, blah, blah, blah. And then she just does it in 2 seconds and this joyous little noise she makes of glee. It's just so funny. And I love some of the writing parts, like the bit about, my dear, nobody could be as stupid as he seems. And also, again, with Scaroff, that bit where Romana tries to bluff him about, oh, well, why should I care about, I forget, it was Duggan or the scientist or something, why should I care about these people? And the second Scaroff threatens them, she tries to stop him and he's just like, yeah, well, that was a bluff, wasn't it? Knowing those words, but it was much better from him. But, yeah, they've got some good stuff like that. But then there's also, going back to a bad point I missed earlier, there's this whole sequence where they're like, when they're following Scaroff and going back to prehistoric Earth, and it's like, oh, we have to get to the TARDIS in minutes. And then they do all these long shots of like, oh, here's a bit of Paris scenery, here's another bit of Paris scenery. And it's like, yeah, you're not really selling the we've got to go there in really quick, are you? But one of the bits that I really do love, and I have to say they must have done a good job predicting the future there, is the bit at the start where Romana's complaining about the art and saying, you know, you can get perfectly good computer pictures, and the Doctor gets really off at her. And, I mean, it's pretty cool that even in 1979, Doctor Who hated AI art before it was a thing. That was pretty clever of them.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people are always going to mention the padding in this story. It's there, but I'm so glad the padding in this is some very, very wonderful shots of Paris with the Doctor, Romana and Duggan running around, as opposed to an entire episode set in the TARDIS where the Doctor's forced to talk backwards and just have a bit of a bitch fest with the Master, you know, that kind of thing. So I'm happy that at least the padding, even the padding in this is unique, I guess is the point I'm trying to make. But yeah, I can see why it's not to everyone's taste. You know, the humour does go a bit far and the stuff about flying is somewhat bizarre. But the Doctor did jump off the top of a building in the Android Invasion. So maybe Time Lords can fly. Maybe that's a thing that we've just not explored yet. Maybe that'll be a big iconic moment in Doctor Who at some point in the future.
That'll really help him at the end of Legopolis when he falls off the oh, whoops.
Well, yeah. Well, he couldn't fly that day, obviously. He can only like fly on Wednesdays or something like that. Must be it. But yes, I don't know. I don't really know where they were going with that, but it's in there, and it's certainly not enough to take away from all of the wonderful things in this story. So Doctor Who is on a high. Like, we've hit something. We've done something special here. We've made City of Death. It looks great. It looks brilliant. I'm sure the next story is going to maintain these high standards, isn't it? Even though it was filmed before, I think. What I'm really saying is that The Creature from the Pit is nowhere near as good as City of Death. In fact, The Creature from the Pit's nowhere near as good as a lot of Doctor Who. This one is where it gets all studio-bound and silly, and I don't really know why we've done that. There's definitely potential here, but there's too much silly. There's some really weird stuff going on with the structure of the story itself. You know, we've got quite a good villain in this, but we're going to kill her off at the very start of part four. And it just seems a bit of a shame. Erato is bizarre. Yet again, we seem to be setting ourselves the let's make the biggest Doctor Who villain ever challenge, because that worked so well with the Power of Krull. I've not got much to say about this one. It's there, it's four parts, it happens, there are some dreadful guest performances in it. There are also some great moments, like K-9 reading Peter Rabbit and that kind of thing, but I don't think this is a story where the good outweighs the bad. The result is forgettable, for want of a better word. Greg, maybe you remember it better than I do.
I mean, I think Creature from the Pit is it's not as bad as its reputation. I'll say that. It's a story that is widely considered, you know, a ridiculous joke, and I think there are elements of it that do work. I think David Fisher was a very underrated contributor to the classic series, maybe the most underrated writer. I mean, he wrote the first draft of City of Death. I mean, Android Zatara, Stones of Blood, Leisure Hive, like, these are all solid Doctor Who stories. And I think the ideas here are certainly interesting. And I also like that the story comes in stages. I mean, yes, killing the villain off at the start of episode four takes away a compelling figure, but at the same time, it lets the story shift, you know, priorities from one, you know, area to another. Now we have to, you know, save the planet versus we have to rescue the ambassador, etc. It's flat, it's studio bound, it just doesn't have a sense of excitement to it. This is the first story in which we really get to hear David, is it Brierley, I think, take on K-9, his voice, and it's I think it works better here than in any of the rest of season 17, just because, I don't know, he plays K-9 is just completely exasperated with everything, and I like that. And I think Lala Ward's great here too. This was the first one they filmed, I believe, and at this point she had virtually no guidance on how to play Romana. So in this story, she tried to kind of do a Mary Tam impression, you know, and do that more aristocratic thing. And perhaps because her father was a peer of the realm, I don't know, but she's very, very good at it. In the scene where she, you know, basically assumes control of the peasantry is quite impressive. There's also just open, overt silliness here. Like, and I don't know if blowing on the monster's tentacle was in the script or if that was just a Tom Baker improvisation. I could certainly see either one, but that's fourth wall breaking to me. That's just like being too silly. That's just like, okay, this thing looks like crap and we're acknowledging to the world that it does. I can't in good conscience say this is a good Doctor Who story, because it isn't, but I do think there's a lot of entertainment to be found here, and it can certainly get worse. I mean, this is leaps and bounds better than Destiny of the Daleks, so if nothing else, we have that going for it.
You see, I think I'd pick this as the weakest from the season. I think I'd pick Destiny over this as a better story, but we're certainly talking about the weakest two. Jimmy, what about you? Talk to us about Creature from the Pit.
Yeah, it's certainly the dud of the season, but I don't think it's that bad. I mean, I think a lot of the jokes that didn't work and the padding and that, I think it could have made an excellent two-parter, put it that way. But yeah, the whole scene at the start with Doctor and K-9 reading a kid's book for some reason, it's just so silly. And then Romana knows it, which is even weirder because, like, you know, the Doctor, sure, he's obsessed with Earth, but why has Romana read this random kid's book? It's just weird. But later gag with reading, I thought at first when Doctor's stuck down the pit and he's reading a book about climbing out of pits and he's like, oh no, it's in Tibetan. And it's just so silly because, of course, he's got the translation circuit anyway. But then they just double down on it, and they're doubling down on it with the Doctor taping out their How to Read Tibetan book. That actually sort of, you know, it crossed the line twice. It went from being not that funny as they thought it was to, okay, yeah, that actually is funny. Errata was such a weird looking thing. Like, that was, you've already said it all, but it's just such an odd choice. For me, the thing I do have to say, though, with the performances and sort of disagreeing with both of you there, the new canine doesn't work for me. I mean, he was barely in the previous two stories, so I didn't really say much there, but I just don't like his performance. It's just such a pity they couldn't get Leeson back. But I'd also disagree. Johnston, you said about all of the guest cast were bad, and I wouldn't go that far because there was one who was good, and I think that was Baildon as Organon. Was just, I loved him. He was brilliant. I mean, I'm not sure if this episode's going out first or our one on the Unbound audios, but I've already talked there about how much I loved his performance there, and I think he did really well here with this sort of cheeky, not actually knowing any of the future, but pretending to sort of prophet mystic thing. And especially that line where he's talking about, you know, I forget the exact wording in the first part, but the bits about, oh yeah, the past explained, the future foretold, and the present apologized for, which I think is just such an excellent line. I absolutely loved that. And so I think he saved the story for me. I think without him, you would be right. All the rest of the guest cast were pretty terrible, but yeah, he salvaged it for me.
I don't think all the guest casts are bad. Yeah, Baildon's brilliant. I'm so glad we've had a Doctor Who with Jeffrey Baildon in, you know, before Big Finish. This is. I also think, is it Lady Adastra? I've forgotten her name. I think it's Lady Adastra, main baddie. I think she's actually quite good. I a bit over the top, but you know, this is not the most over the top villain performance this season. I don't know. There's a few performances in this where I sort of go, is that what we're doing? Is that the level we're pitching this at? Or, yeah. There's even a moment from Romana that's not amazing when we think K-9's been killed at the end of the first part and the sort of, oh no, not K-9. It's a bit dreadful. Anyway, never mind. It's there. It's harmless. It's not doing any damage. Yeah, it's certainly not a Doctor Who story I would choose to show somebody that's never seen classic Doctor Who before, though, because this is not classic Doctor Who firing on all cylinders. This is not the leads at their best, the production at its best, the scripting at its best. Just misses the mark for me, unfortunately. Next up is a story that, as I said before, doesn't miss the mark for me. It's Nightmare of Eden, which is, it's a bizarre story. I'm not going to say it's fantastic. I think it's a shame that, at least from my point of view, Bob Baker writes better Doctor Who when he's not got his co-writer with him. I think this is better than any Bob and Dave efforts we've had over the years. It's a lot of fun. I'm not sure it's the best story to be a lot of fun. It's about a very addictive and dangerous drug that does sort of drive people mad and kill them. We do see a few people driven mad and killed by this drug. It should be particularly harrowing. I appreciate we're not going to get Requiem for a Dream or Trainspotting in Doctor Who, but here we are. It's a really odd one because this is pretty much played as an out-and-out comedy, particularly by Tom Baker. We've got a guest actor putting on a very curious accent. I'm not sure what it's meant to be, but it's an accent and it's there. Some interesting ideas. You know, at the end of the day, it's an episode that should be full of drama and full of disaster. There are spaceship crashes, there are monsters tearing people to shreds, there are people being killed by drugs, and the tone is just bizarre. But despite all of this, I thoroughly enjoy this story. I think it's just a really, really enjoyable, entertaining bit of Doctor Who. And I think that this probably is the one that, should we say, most hits perhaps what Douglas Adams was going for. I think that City of Death and Sharda, which were written by Douglas Adams, at least to a large extent, are the most Douglas Adams-y. But I think in terms of what he wants a guest writer to come in and do, this is probably it. Also, it's a story that doesn't perhaps have a script which exceeds the capabilities of the production, which Bob Baker, again, you know, was it perhaps Dave Martin that was making everything a bit beyond what we could produce? I don't know. I really enjoy this story anyway. I think there's a lot to enjoy there. It's far from perfect, but if you had to pick a bit of season 17 Doctor Who that generally works that wasn't actually written by Douglas Adams himself, this is the one that I'd go for. Greg, go for it.
Well, I disagree quite a bit there. I don't really like this story much at all. And I think the issue primarily that I have with it is that more than any other story in the season, and that includes Destiny of the Daleks, this one has the most conflict for me between the intent of the script writer and the intent of the script editor. You know, like you said, Bob Baker is pitching this as a serious story about drug addiction and drug trafficking. And Douglas Adams just takes that and throws all kinds of ridiculous humor into it. And, oh, my arms, my legs, my everything, you know, that sort of thing, which is just explicitly over the top silly. And because the story is trying to be serious about its subject matter, but at the same time is so ridiculous in other places, to me, it doesn't work at all. Like that conflict of tone is too much. And it really feels like the story is being pulled in two different directions. I also think the directing of the story is quite flat and poor. I feel like the actors in this, for the most part, like, weren't getting any guidance. Like, I see Lala Ward in this, and I see an actor who doesn't know what she's supposed to be doing. And so she's just affecting a lot of, you know, confusion for her character. But I feel like what she's doing doesn't really fit with the script. I mean, you mentioned, you know, Kerensky and the weird accent that's there, and that's doesn't really seem to fit with the script. I mean, think about Tom Baker in this, you know, like I said, my arms, my legs, my everything line, and then yet at the same time, just the very cold, dismissive, you know, go away that he gives to Kerensky at the very end. It just doesn't hold together for me. And because of that, like, I really start to notice the shabby production values, and the mandrels look just awful. And I don't know. I do agree that this, for once, is something that's actually capturable on a BBC budget. It's very easy to do, just all studio bound. But the idea of, you know, two ships colliding and being fused together is still a very ambitious sci-fi idea. Where do I rank it in the pantheon of Bob Baker Doctor Who? I don't know. It's hard to say. It's certainly not at the top for me, though. And that would still be probably The Mutants, although I concede that it's not the best set of stories to pick from. But yeah, this one just doesn't work for me. And I would much rather watch Creature from the Pit, to be honest with you.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I can't particularly argue. I don't know. I can't really pin what it is I like so much about this story down, to be honest. I just find it to be a thoroughly entertaining 90 minutes, whereas I don't find Creature from the Pit or Destiny of the Daleks to be that. But that's the magic of Doctor Who. It entertains us even when it's in ways that's perhaps not intended. Jimmy, talk to us about Nightmare of Eden.
I definitely enjoyed it more than Greg, but I don't think quite as much as yourself. I think the thing that I really noticed with this story when I was making my little notes for the episode, almost every note that I made was, oh, that's a brilliant line, but the thing as a greater whole doesn't really hold together quite as well as it could, but there's lots of great lines in this one, like the one about, oh, of course we should interfere, always do what you're best at, and the one about the doctor liking doing the impossible and comparing Trist's conserving animals to conserving fruit, or the one about bureaucrats being worse than idiots. It's just so many great lines through this story, but there's also some that really don't fit, like as you were both saying before about the whole my arms, my legs, my everything, and the other one that's on the opposite extreme that's really jarring tone-wise is, and I'm surprised neither of you commented or neither of you picked it up, but there's that character who got trapped in the sort of hallucination vision piece of the planets thing. He just casually mentions that, a few times I was tempted to blow my brains out, and it's like, holy, how did they get away with that in the 70s? They definitely wouldn't have got away with that today. I mean, that is dark, and it really, you know, suddenly shifts the tone quite dramatically. But other than things like that that were a bit off, I enjoyed it for the most part. I think it's a really good story and definitely underrated.
Yeah, it's always going to be the main thing that comes up about this story is just the tone is all over the place. And I do think Greg summed it up quite well, actually, where just what Bob Baker was asking for and what Douglas Adams was asking for were very, very different things. I quite like that conflict of style. And I think that I'm not sure a late 1970s gritty drama about drug trafficking and drug addiction would have been as good as this. I think on its own, it wouldn't have an awful lot to offer, maybe, but or at least it wouldn't be produced as well as it could be. At the end of the day, this is Doctor Who, this is not gangsters. But yeah, it's there, it's part of the season, and it's one that I will occasionally dig out and enjoy for the bizarre bit of a mess, I guess, that it is. Let's move on. Let's move on to The Horns of Nymon, which is at least the story that everyone seems to be on the same page about, I think, is the best way to describe it. There's no conflict of style here. We're going down the route of essentially adapting a Greek myth again. We did this with Underworld. It wasn't a runaway success, but let's keep going. There are some ideas in this that are absolutely brilliant. There's some really, really dark stuff in this, you know, the sacrificing of children to aliens and entire planets wiped out by Nymon. Nymon, not visually the greatest villain ever, but they certainly serve their purpose. There's certainly a real sense of menace around them. I particularly like the sort of vocal effect that's used on them. You know, they do sound like big, scary, godlike creatures, even if they don't particularly look like it. Sol Eed, I think, is another love him or hate him kind of character. I love him. I love the fact that I think it's a wonderful performance. I think it absolutely gets this sort of weakling coward that has been given power outside his capability to wield, and it's driven him slightly bonkers as a result. I think it works really well. There are moments in that performance where you just sort of think, perhaps a little bit too far, but for the most part, I think it's pitched perfectly. Like, he's slightly bonkers, he's a bit of a weedy man, and the Nymon have promoted him beyond his capability, I guess. Some great moments for Romana here. She has her own sonic screwdriver that she made herself, and the Doctor tries to nick it because it's better. some really good material for Canine in this one. I even love some of the sillier moments, you know, the Doctor trying to escape guards, running out into a town square and sort of shouting, you know, doing a bit of a speech, you know, as unaccustomed as I am to public speaking, that kind of thing. It's fun. And I think it gets the fun part right. And we also kind of get the idea of playing cricket with the TARDIS before Four to Doomsday does it, which, again, I think works relatively well. So Horns of Nymon, Greg, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm on the same page as you and as a lot of other fans. I think there's really no objective way to look at the story and say it was made well, but at the same time, like, they just lean into it, really, and they're out of money. You know, they spent the budget on the location shooting for City of Death, and they're just scrambling to put this together. The script is vaguely ridiculous on its own, and so the cast just decides to take that and turn it up to 11. I think that Tom Baker and Graham Crowden, like, playing against one another, just, you know, trying to one up each other is a lot of fun. I think it's a very enjoyable story in that way. I agree. It does give Romana quite a bit to do. It's one of Lal Ward's best stories in Doctor Who, I would say, which is interesting given, you know, what's surrounding her. And I love the Nymon in this. In that, that's probably in part because I remember as a kid, I thought the Nymon were terrifying. Like when people are running through the power complex and the walls are shifting and the Nymon could be around any corner. Like, I remember being, like, gripped by that and being terrified, like, oh no, there could be a Nymon, you know, right now. But the costumes look ridiculous, but I do like the voices, and I do I like the way that they're characterized. I like the way that the story is structured so that you spend a good chunk of it thinking there is just that, you know, the Nymon is just this one individual, but then it turns out it's an entire race. I like that the story shifts focus and you end up going to another planet that the Nymon conquered. Like, I think there's a lot of good ideas here. And I think the fact that they realized the execution wasn't going to be good, and so they very deliberately, it seems to me, just lean into that and make it work anyway. I would have a really hard time, like, giving this a letter grade or anything like that, but I it's bad and yet I love it, I guess, is the best way to put it. And if anyone wants to put on the Horns of Nymon, I will always sit there and enjoy it.
I think that's the point. It's mostly a harmless story. It's whereas City of Death is everyone firing on all cylinders, this is just everyone finding the right tone, hitting it, and enjoying themselves for better and for worse. And I think, particularly with this era, you can tell when Tom's enjoying himself. You can tell when Tom doesn't want to be there. This is an enjoying himself one, which definitely does show, yeah. Jimmy, go ahead.
Yeah, it's just so ridiculous and silly and funny. It's just a joy. It's, crazy. I love so many quotable bits like the weakling scum and how many Nymons have you seen today and so on. It's excellent. And yeah, the Nymons' voices were so well realised. And I think the concept too, it's like, it's hard to take it seriously in this episode, but when they brought the Nymon back on audio, and it's like, I mean, you know, they've got power over black holes, they can do all this cool stuff. It's just like, yeah, it wasn't obviously executed here as well as it perhaps could have been if they had a budget. But it's just so fun. And Graham Crowden is so ridiculously silly and over the top in every single moment. It is absolutely brilliant. I'm very glad that he never got to be the Doctor like he was apparently considered instead of Tom. But thank goodness that didn't happen. But here he's just excellent as a hilarious guest star. And I think the lack of budget also even works for it in places. Like at the start, the spaceship transporting the slaves looks so battered and crap and old, and then you get the dialogue between the two people piloting it, and it's like, oh, that's because it is intentionally a crappy old, dodgy, on its last legs spaceship. And then, yeah, I also loved the Romana Sonic bit. That was very good. The Kanine getting CPR gag was a bit too ridiculous, but, I mean, the whole story is, so that's okay. And I loved the other line from Romana later on about when the doctor's saying about Soldier not knowing what he was talking about, and she's just like, oh, well, people often don't know what you're talking about, and it's just such a good burn. I love it. It's just so ridiculous and fun. It's just, yeah, it's the most season 17 of season 17. It's just exemplifying that fun, that no budget, that, yeah, it's just such a good story. And I think everyone's mostly being silly, but Romana, Lala Ward, takes it so seriously in some of the scenes. It's just, it almost makes it funnier, like everyone else is joking around and having fun and Romana's taking it seriously. It just adds to it. I love it.
I think quite a chunk of this season works so well because, you know, if the Fourth Doctor and Romana were a comedy duo, Romana would be the straight man. She'd be the one that the other one bounces off. And it does work really, really well, having her a little bit more grounded, a little bit more serious. Not quite as grounded and serious as Mary Tam's Romana. This is definitely a more light-hearted Romana. That's even a plot point in Big Finish's Gallifrey series. Talking of Big Finish, has to be said, they brought back the Nymon brilliantly. Spoilers ahead. The story is Seasons of Fear. They don't appear till sort of the very end, or the last episode at least, but great story, really well done, and really does show that there's nothing wrong with them as a villain at all. You know, any problems that the world has had with the Nymon all along were other problems with this story and not the Nymon themselves. But to be perfectly honest, I think watching Horns of Nymon is like getting on a roller coaster. You've just got to go with it. Let's move on then to the story that never made it, Sharda, which I really wish we'd have got. I really wish they'd have found a way of finishing it somehow. And JNT thought about it, and you know, a lot of people involved would have, by all accounts, go for it. I mean, most people involved have probably recorded this story 4 or 5 times now. There are so many different versions of it. Ironically, it's probably the Doctor Who story that exists the most. But the original thing is definitely a thing of beauty. It has all the problems of a 70s Doctor Who 6-parter. There is the padding, there is, you know, other bits as well that maybe we didn't need. It's possibly falls apart in its last couple of episodes. I definitely prefer the Cambridge part of the story, but I can't complain. This is a good story. This is an awful lot of fun. It's a great script. It's, as far as Doctor Who's concerned, this would be Douglas Adams' sort of magnum opus. This is Douglas Adams' big Doctor Who, and it's such a shame it just never made it across the finish line. From what we can see from the existing footage, and most of the story exists, and also, you know, from what has been recreated, particularly in animation, you know, we're sort of looking at the animated version maybe here. So we said we were last time we did season by season. That's what we were focusing on. I think it works incredibly well. And sticking with the animated version, the cameo from actual Tom at the end, 2017 Tom at the end, was just absolutely fantastic. What a wonderful little, I guess, Easter egg to throw at the end of the story. It really does feel like we're missing something special here. It perhaps hurts more than any, you know, missing from the 60s, aka not in the archive story. The fact that they got so close with this, arguably more than once, and it just never quite made it across the finish line is such a shame. But I'm so glad that we do have a few versions of this that we can enjoy now. You know, the audio version with Paul McGann is absolutely great, and kind of fits in with the continuity of this and the Five Doctors and everything. The VHS version with Tom Baker recording Lynx is very, very good. It's a lot of fun. But for me, the animated version, the 2017 version, is always going to be the default version of this story now. And I, like I say, I'm just really glad it exists. It's a wonderful, wonderful piece of Doctor Who. It should have been there to wrap up the late 70s Graham Williams era in a nice little bow. I know it would have been entirely broadcast in the 80s had it made it, but this is the end of 70s Doctor Who, and it's just a shame that it never quite happened. But that's enough from me. Go ahead, Greg, talk to us about Sharda.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a unique story for so many reasons, and especially because it wasn't finished. You know, you mentioned the missing episodes from the 60s, and yeah, I mean, obviously that's tragic, but those were finished. Those were broadcast. People did see them, and in fact, we have the audio from all of them. So at the very least, like, you can listen to the authentic performances that we had, whereas here, a lot of it just wasn't made. So yeah, I mean, it's great in the animation that they got as much of the surviving original cast together as they could, and you still hear their takes on it. But I mean, this is, you know, 40 years after the story was supposed to be made, so of course it's going to sound different. You know, you mentioned the VHS version, and that has a special place in my heart because, you know, when I was a kid, like, there really was no, you know, internet as we know it now. So like, my knowledge of Doctor Who came from Doctor Who reference books that I would get. And so I knew that there was an episode of Doctor Who called Sharda that had never been made, and or had been partially made, but then had been scrapped because of a strike. And so it was always like, oh, and I knew from the reference books that, you know, the couple of clips in The Five Doctors of Tom Baker were from Sharda. So I knew that. But at the same time, it was just this thing. I was like, okay, well, you know, they never made it. Like, I'm never going to see it. And that's that. And then one day I was in a video store and I saw Sharda on a VHS tape. And I was like, what? And so I think I was with my grandparents at the time, and I pestered them until they bought it for me. And it was awesome. And yeah, I will always love this story for reasons like that. As a story, it's very good. It's six parts. So like you said, it does drag a bit. It's actually the last six part story. I mean, I know there's the two doctors, which is 3:45 minutes, but this is the last six episode story. And, it is padded a bit, but again, like, I think one thing that this era is very good at, and maybe this is Douglas Adams's influence, is we're not focusing on the same plot thread the entire time. Like, the focus of the story changes. You know, first there's the mystery about, you know, Professor Chronotis, and who is Skagra, what does he want? And then, you know, things slowly shift as we find out more and more information. We find out what Sharda is. We go there. I mean, it keeps building. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it all works. I love the updated, you know, the modern animated version. I love hearing all the original voice actors. I think that scene you mentioned at the end with, you know, an aged Tom Baker, you know, standing at the TARDIS console, oh, he was such a nice old man. You know, I think that's a beautiful sequence. I think the script in general is very funny. It's quite good. It's Douglas Adams through and through. In fact, this pretty much became the plot of the first, or part of the plot of the first Dirk Gently novel. I enjoy this. And, you know, we talk about like different things being definitive and so on. And I think every version of this has its own, you know, beautiful redeeming factors to it. The VHS version, this version, the Big Finish version is great. The novel that was adapted by James Goss is great. It's a story that's been represented in many ways, and pretty much every time they represent it, they do it well. And, you know, I will say, like, again, that VHS version, I don't know why, but the way that Tom Baker goes into one of the cliffhangers in his recap segment, you know, dead men do not require oxygen. I don't know. I think of his reading of that as the definitive take on the line more so than the actual, you know, actress who did the voice in the animated version. And so that's why I think Shada is a unique and wonderful piece of Doctor Who. I mean, on the one hand, yes, I do wish that they had been able to just make the whole thing and release it. But on the other hand, I think it's kind of a beautiful thing that we have this story that has so many takes on it, and none of them are definitive, really, and none of them are right. And I think that's a very Doctor Who thing to have with a Doctor Who story.
Forgive my moment of pedantry, Greg, but Flux is the last six-part Doctor Who story. But I know exactly what you mean.
Oh, well, can you blame me for forgetting that?
but no, it's, yeah, absolutely spot on. It's... I'm glad so many versions of this story exist. I'm glad that there have been so many stabs at it, but ultimately it was the animation that really got there for me. It was the one that really made me feel as though I had now seen Shada. Jimmy, go ahead.
See, for me, the thing with Shada is the first version of it that I experienced was the Big Finish Eighth Doctor version. And so for me, that one is the definitive. So it's, I mean, as a season 17 story, it's just another sort of generic-y later period Tom story, whereas when they shifted it to the Eighth Doctor, it was so different. Like with the Eighth Doctor was usually at that time more serious or dark in some of the stories, and this was just him getting to be absolutely lighthearted, and hearing him with Romana, who in this version is long past adventuring and gone back to it, she's president of Gallifrey, and having the proper K-9 instead of the David Brearley one, like, and just the guest cast. For me, the Eighth Doctor version is the definitive. And, I mean, I enjoyed when I rewatched it, the original, but for me, it's just, it doesn't feel right. It's just those bits belong to the five Doctors and the rest of it can just sort of, yeah, just doesn't work for me as well. So, yeah, sorry, I'm an Eighth Doctor version. I'm one of the people who prefers that over the actual original. So I'm glad we got it, but I'm glad they animated the original version too, and it's nice that they have all the different versions, as you were saying.
I love the fact that, as far as I'm concerned, the original and the Eighth Doctor version can coexist, like part of the Eighth Doctor version and the Five Doctors and Time Me Messed With. It kind of, if you squint,
yeah, they explained it so well in that lead-in scene for the audio. Like, I mean, it's just so clever that they've managed to make something good out of the fact that Tom wasn't in the Five Doctors and they had to do this, and then it became this explanation that allowed a whole different version of the story. It's it worked out well in the end.
Yeah, and I really like the way that's done, and, you know, the Big Finish one wasn't shut out, because the Big Finish one is an absolutely brilliant production, just the animated version and the audio-only version. I did the audio-only version for the first time not all that long ago, and thought it worked so well. It was great. And, you know, when you think about it, it's such an obvious thing to do. I guess it's the first lost story that Big Finish did. I absolutely adore both versions, and I will always revisit both versions. But, you know, thank God we have got a complete Shada, and thank God they put it into episodic form for the Blu-ray, because I remember when everyone received it and it came as a 2.5-hour film and they were like, "What? Where are my cliffhangers?" And, you know, this is a story that has some pretty good cliffhangers. It's a shame to chop that out. You know, Greg mentioned dead men do not require oxygen. That's great. The sort of the bike chase in part two that concludes with the Doctor being trapped with the sphere, that's brilliant. It's really good. It would have been a real shame had they not gone back and done that for the season 17 Blu-ray. I'm very glad they did. But I think that's us done. I think that's it. Season 17 sorted, finished. It's been a roller coaster. It's an odd season. It's all over the place. I think had we got another season of Douglas Adams, I think tonally it might have been a little bit more solid. We'd have got more City of Deaths and Shardas and less Creature from the Pits and Nightmare of Edens or whatever. But I think ultimately we've had a an enjoyable season here. I hesitate to call it a good season, but it's certainly an enjoyable season. And Sharda is a great way to round it off. Sharda is certainly a better end to this particular era than Horns of Nymon is. So I'm glad we have all of that. So we'll leave it there. That is that's an episode of Spodcast done. We'll be back for the first part of season 18 with season by season soon. I think we're splitting it into two because it's a big season and there's K9 and Company as well. And there's, you know, we've got to say goodbye to Tom Baker, which I think might take a bit of time. So season 18, season by season, will be two parts. But in the meantime, I will say a big thank you and goodbye to Greg.
Lord Nymon!
I think I might have to sort of cut that out, put it on a button so I can just play it at any point during any podcast from now on. That was wonderful.
You have my permission.
Oh, even better. And a big, big thank you and goodbye to Jimmy.
So this is the great journey of life.
At least the great journey of season 17. Well, we'll be back for more Spodcasting very soon. Goodbye now.